This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Milwaukee has a long history as a place for people to gather, not only during its time as a modern city, but long before when indigenous groups would meet and trade in the area. The name Milwaukee is itself derived from the different languages of the many tribes who came to the area. For most Native Americans in Wisconsin, these languages are no longer what they speak at home or in everyday use. But there are efforts to change that, to revitalize the language and reestablish its prominence in their communities. Michael Zimmerman Jr. is an indigenous language specialist and consultant. He's also a member of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi. He joins me now to talk about his work. Michael, thank you so much for being here on Lake Effect.
Thank you.
How many native languages are spoken in Wisconsin today?
So today, of the nations that are in Wisconsin, you have several bands of Ojibwe. So Ojibwe, or some people refer to them as Chippewa, the language there, Anishinaabemowin, is spoken amongst those groups. So that is a language that is still very vibrant. Then you have Neshnaabemowin, which is the Potawatomi version and Forest County Potawatomi, still has speakers that are around for that language. Oneida language is still actively being taught. Some of their speakers they have access to are from Canada. Some of them are from here, but those are still viable languages. Ho-Chunk language is spoken by the Ho-Chunk people. A lot of people refer to them as Winnebago. That's actually an Ojibwe word for them, but their name is Ho-Chunkra, which is people of the big voice or great voice. That's their name for themselves. Menominee language is still spoken. They probably have the fewest amount of speakers left of all the tribes that are in Wisconsin, except for perhaps Stockbridge Muncie, which they have two language programs going, one in the Muncie dialect of what would we consider the Delaware language, and then Mohican language, which is closely related, but isn't exactly the same. So everyone has language programming going on in terms of the degree to which their language is endangered or in danger of going dormant. It's in varying states.
You know, as you're saying, a lot of these languages are endangered or have gone through phases in which they've been endangered, where there have been few speakers, especially native speakers. When we look back historically, can we pinpoint a time where these languages began to disappear?
I don't know that I would say disappear even. I mean, a lot of them change form in one way or another, and that's actually something that has naturally occurred. In terms of being a lingua franca or a popularly used language or a language that's vibrant in an entire community, a lot of people point to the boarding school era as a time wherein which Native children were, in many cases forcibly, in some cases by choice, put into an establishment where they were not allowed to speak their language openly, were not allowed to, you know, dress in a traditional manner or express or practice any of their traditional customs. In many cases, there would be means of punishment for doing such. For many languages, that was a means by which to assist in removing personal sovereignty and tribal sovereignty as far as language goes from a lot of nations.
For people who went through boarding schools, obviously at some of these schools it was discouraged speaking their native language. When they came out of these schools, was that a feeling that transferred to their everyday lives, or were there still people who were, you know, very much inside of their culture continuing to speak?
I think you definitely had examples of both. You know, as far as my family goes and my family's experience, you know, my great-grandfather went through that, and he was a member of our tribal council up until the 1970s. And back in those times, those generations held their council meetings completely in the language. So clearly, for that generation or generations a little bit before them, they were still able to keep that going, but it didn't transfer over into the generations that came after for the most part.
So when you look at the work of revitalizing a language, what does that encompass? What are you doing with that work?
Well, it encompasses essentially everything. It just depends on what degree to which you're engaging with it. So if you look at the term revitalize, it's to bring back to life or to bring back vibrancy. You know, that's something that when folks use term like immersion, for example, well, effective immersion means that you're engaging in multiple topics over a span of time, hopefully with a multitude of speakers that are from varying backgrounds and thus providing various contexts. That's what really is most effective. And so essentially it's utilizing something on a day-to-day basis for every single thing that you're doing. That's essentially the end goal. The degree to which that is happening or is gradually increasing is going to vary depending on how much that gets engaged with.
You mentioned before that, of course, these are languages that are complex. When we're talking about different bands, are we also talking about different dialects?
Potentially. How those groups come about are for different reasons for different groups. But definitely in terms of language, I mean, you have instances where people that are in certain households will speak certain ways versus people from other households in the same community. Dialect is a thing that, you know, even in the word use itself, die refers to at least two. So as long as you have a mutual communication, you know, you have a representation possibly of a dialect. I remember a friend of mine telling me a word that where he was from in Oklahoma, Kimosabe, is a word that means, so that word, a lot of people understand it to be from like the Lone Ranger, for example, is Kimosabe. And the thing about that is the individual who was responsible for coming up with that radio show, which then became a TV series and movies and such, that person was from Southwest Michigan, where my people were from. And that word refers to someone looking around in a sneaky manner. So it's a verb. He or she looks around in a sneaky manner. And this word my friend was telling me about in Oklahoma, they use that word for when they're talking about somebody who's peeping around or being nosy or something like that, which is funny because it's like that's not what the word is actually saying. But it, when you take the understanding of looking around in a sneaky manner, I mean, essentially that can be applied to many situations. But, you know, that's the breadth of language, I guess.
Sure. Now, that gets to a question I have, and I'm going to focus on Ojibwe since that's what you're teaching. When we talk about language, it becomes so complicated because what language does conceptually is really different depending on the kind of language it is. When we look at the concepts present in Ojibwe, how words have evolved their more complex meanings, how do you impart that cultural understanding to students who may not speak this language at home?
So you essentially try to replicate what first language speakers do, and that's being able to play with what are referred to as morphemes or the parts of the words that hold the meaning. And this is not just true of Ojibwe. This is also true of Potawatomi, of Odawa, of a lot of other languages. And so when doing that, you know, you do need to know where words come from, and you should also be aware of when you're putting those together responsibly, how are you doing it in a way where the word begins properly and ends properly, and knowing the parts and where the parts separate when you're putting together something like this. And so it's almost like a language Lego type thing that you're doing when you're actually playing with it. And so just to give you an example, like if you were going to say Minowaki, so Minowaki in Ojibwe refers to land that is well or good. And it's talking about the city of Milwaukee or the land that Milwaukee sits on. Mino is a little morpheme part that refers to good or well. The uki at the end is referring to essentially anything that is within physical existence, but it's also referring to land or earth or dirt or soil, which is essentially the plane upon which human beings exist. We do not live under the ground, and we do not live in the air or in the water. We live on the earth, traditionally anyway. So then anyway, when we're talking about the formation of those words, you know, then you can play with them in different ways. And so, for example, bimadeze means to move along in existence. He or she moves along in existence. The bime part refers to moving along or going about, or specifically on a trajectory. Adeze means to be alive or to just exist. And so if you were going to say minobimadeze, he or she exists or moves along in existence, good or well, you know, now we're starting to formulate slightly longer words, getting a little bit more descriptive in what's going on. If you say ditibise, it means either it moves or he or she moves in a rolling manner or fashion. And so it means he or she rolls or it rolls. If you're going to say ditibaga, that means the bug refers to a leaf and the ah is making it a verb action. So a rolled or it is a rolled leaf or it is a even possibly a tumbling leaf. But if you were going to say ditibagasin, that means that the wind is blowing this rolled leaf or the wind is causing the leaf to roll along or something along those lines. It just depends on how you want to play with the word.
Another question I had, sort of along the same lines. Most of your students are going to be native English or Spanish speakers. Are there phonemes that are present in Ojibwe, in Potawatomi, that are difficult for native English or Spanish speakers?
Yes and no. So you're saying the phonemes, so the sound portions or the sound particles. There are certain consonant clusters that you find in those languages that you mentioned that are indigenous versus English or Spanish that you don't find in English or Spanish is essentially what I'm saying. And so we use a lot of shk or shki sounds when we're speaking. You know, that consonant cluster is not something that you commonly hear in English at all. And there are definitely other examples of that. In terms of the alphabets, you know, in both instances of Potawatomi and Ojibwe, for example, you do have alphabets that look very similar to the Roman orthography that English uses. What is a little bit different is when you start getting into the vowel sounds, and in some cases, when you start getting into writing specific either consonants or consonant clusters. And I'll give you a good example of that. In Ojibwe, when you're wanting to express a ch sound, you would write ch. But in Potawatomi, that same sound is written with a tth, at least for Forest County and a couple of other bands. With the j sound, that's written with a J in Ojibwe. In English, similar thing, it's written with a J. But in a Potawatomi, it's written with a TH instead. Aside from those specific examples, the only other thing that is often kind of like a curveball that you don't hear a ton of in English, but you do have examples. There's a lot more usage in Ojibwe and Potawatomi, especially Potawatomi, of glottal stops, where in the midst of pronouncing a word, there's a pause. And so in Ojibwe, one of the better examples of that is the word for wolf, which is ma'ingan. And it's ma'ingan as a pause in the middle of that pronunciation. Your glottis is your throat, and so you're pausing in the midst of emanating that sound. In Potawatomi, for example, that same word is ma'ewe, ma'ewe. And that, again, you hear the pause in there. And oftentimes that's expressed in the written form utilizing an apostrophe. Whereas in English, you don't have too many examples of that. In Spanish, not so much either.
Hmm. Now, this is kind of a big question, but when you look at the work you do with language revitalization, why do you think it's important to revive languages and ensure that future generations carry them forward?
There's two answers to that. I think on the macro level, there's something about ideology of place and time. And to remember or to have a responsibility to pass on that, you know, there are ways in which much of what is going on or has gone on has been thought of in ways that are different than what the vox populi knows of today. And so in engaging with that, not to say that any of the either Afro-Asiatic or Indo-European or other language groups don't engage in this process as well, but to say that many of the indigenous languages actively engage more with process and action is something that I think most people can take something from. On a micro level, when you acquire something and you know that generations and generations of individuals that came before you acquired as well, you kind of feel that responsibility to then pass it on in some form or fashion to the generations that come after you as to keep up that connection.
All right. Well, Michael, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Miigwech, thank you.
Michael Zimmerman Jr. is an Indigenous language specialist and consultant. He's also a member of the Pokagon Band of Potawatomi. You can hear more interviews like this one by visiting the Lake Effect page at wuwm.com.